Hey listeners, this is your host Abir Sichter with another episode of Local Global Leaders. Today's episode is titled Show Up, Listen, Get Stuff Done. I sat down with Jacqueline Coleman, the Lieutenant Governor of Kentucky. He was also running for governor. In our conversation, Lieutenant Governor Coleman reflects on her partnership with Governor Andy Beshear and the lessons she's learned as a teacher embedded in her community. And she also talks about how education taught her resilience and even how coaching and sports play such an important role in developing future leaders. And throughout the discussion, she explains how those experiences have helped her turn listening into meaningful action across Kentucky. Now, here's our conversation. Greetings, listeners. I'm here at WUKY radio station with perhaps our biggest guest yet, Lieutenant Governor Jacqueline Coleman. Lieutenant Governor Coleman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
It's been so great to finally meet you in person. I know when I was at the Council of State Governments, had the honor to interview you through Zoom, I think twice. So it's good to finally see you in person. Like, I think that's really her, but now, but now I know. But again, thank you so much for joining us. I wanted to start off by asking you your six-word story. What are six words you'd use to describe yourself?
Six words to describe myself. I think they would be show up, listen, get stuff done.
That's a great combo. And what motivates you to lead and serve your community?
You know, I grew up in a household with my dad was a state representative. And so I had a very close look at public service from a very young age. It shaped our conversations at the dinner table. You know, what I recognized was we had very different conversations than most families did. And a lot of my friends, they didn't know a lot about government and how it works and who makes up the government. And so that's why I became a government teacher, is I wanted young people to know first how government works and next what to do when it doesn't work for you. And in that process, you know, as teachers, you are embedded in your community. I mean, you don't get to pick the students that walk through your door. You don't get to choose their circumstances. And you're working with them and their families, and any community challenges that are in that are out there are in your classroom. And so, really that connection to people and to ways that we can improve the lives of families really settled in with me. And, you know, so that combination of being a teacher, but also coming from a family where I got to see a public servant firsthand, those two things just kind of made sense to me. And then when you realize that in Kentucky, the biggest portion of our state budget is actually education funding, you recognize that we need more people who have walked in those shoes, who truly understand what those investments mean.
Yeah. And it sounds like, I mean, to me, I'm also a former teacher myself, always thought of classrooms as like the front line of, I mean, what's happening to students, of course, but also what families are facing, right?
Absolutely. I always tell people, you know, I had, you know, a former player that I coached basketball call me in the middle of the night to let me know their electricity had been cut off. You know, she didn't call the mayor. She called her coach, you know, and so those relationships that you build with those students, they last a lifetime.
Yeah, they sure do. And, you know, you kind of talked about, like, how that led you to want to run. But can you tell us, like, what was the ignition like that, what ultimately inspired you to decide to run for elected office?
Well, if you think back to, so the governor and I announced in 2018, this was towards the end of the Bevin administration, and the negativity that the Bevin administration had, you know, towards education in general, the way that teachers were disparaged and disrespected, not just in word, but in action, really lit a fire under me. And, you know, I always believed that we deserved better representation, but I realized that I was going to have a chance to be that better representation and to serve as a teacher and to really give a voice to a profession that hadn't had one in government, as well as one that had really been just publicly disrespected by the highest elected official in Kentucky. And I just wasn't going to let that stand.
And can you take us back to that moment in 2018? Like, how did that conversation go when you and Governor Beshear first had that conversation about you all being on the ticket together?
Okay, so this is a great story. Not a lot of people know this, but so Andy and I knew each other. You know, it's small circles in Kentucky, so we knew of each other and had worked together on, you know, like I'd helped his AG campaign, his dad when he ran for governor, those types of things. So one day he calls and says he wants to have coffee. And I thought, well, why in the world does he want to have coffee with me? But okay. But it took us a while to be able to find a time to do it because I was an assistant principal. So I had bus duty. So I had to wait till the last bus left the parking lot before I could go meet with the attorney general, right? Which is crazy to think about, but that was life then. And so we sit down and he starts talking and I can tell he's getting ready to tell me he's running for governor, right? And I just thought, oh, he's going to tell me this and then he's going to ask me to have a fundraiser or something like that, you know, see if I would support him. And then he says, but the first decision I have to make is who I want my running mate to be. And my mouth dropped, and I know I had this shocked look on my face. And he was like, what, is that not what you thought we were going to talk about today? And I said, no, Andy, I just left bus duty. I did not think that you were going to ask me to run as your lieutenant governor. So that's really got to be the only time in history that that's how that conversation started.
That's really funny. That reminds me, when I was a teacher as well in Memphis having bus duty, I had to constantly tell my professor, I was taking like a graduate course, like, hey, I'm going to be late because I'm finishing bus duty this afternoon. So I can relate to that.
The buses wait for no one.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And can you tell us more about how your background as an educator has shaped your approach to leadership? You know, you mentioned as a government teacher, but again, you said you're also an assistant principal, a professor, a coach, and how did all those roles combine, affect how you govern?
You know, as a teacher, again, that personal relationship that you build with your community and really having a front row seat to what people need is important. But I'm telling you what, I think being a coach probably prepared me more for this than anything. Just the tough skin that you have to have as someone who does a job publicly, who wins publicly and loses publicly, right? And the competitive nature of it, that you have to have a game plan. Mm-hmm. You have to anticipate your opponent. You have to respond. You have to win with humility and lose with grace, right? Like all of those things are on full display for you to be not just an example to your own players, but as a community. And so really putting people first, making sure that you fight for the things that you know people deserve, for the people that don't have a voice, has always been, you know, really central to who I am in my profession. And so taking that experience and moving it into state government, it's such a similar role. People think it's so different. They say, well, how in the world did you go from being, you know, an assistant principal to being lieutenant governor? And I'm like, it's really not that different, right? I mean, at the core of it, you know, even coaching is so much, I guess coaching would be like the political side of it. And then teaching would be like the government side of it.
Okay.
It just prepared me for this in a way that I don't think many other people in this role have ever experienced.
That's awesome. Do you think for your running mate, then it sounds like you're going to pick also a coach too?
Well, no, I don't know. So what I will say is this. So Governor Beshear and I we've been a really good team. Mm-hmm. I think he would tell you the same thing. But we are very different people working towards the same mission.
Yeah.
But I think that's complementary, right? So, for example, as a coach, you're not going to recruit 10 of the same players, right? You don't need 10 point guards. You need different pieces of the puzzle that go together. So just like the governor lived in the two largest cities in Kentucky, Lexington and Louisville. I grew up in one of the smallest towns called Bergen, which has 1,000 people and a four-way stop, and that's it. And I was still living in Mercer County when the governor asked me to run with him. You know, he has a profession as an attorney. I was a teacher. And so those perspectives are very different, but we learn from each other. We complement each other. And so I think in choosing my running mate, which I would like to do sooner rather than later, I don't have any dates planned, but I'm looking for somebody who, again, shares the mission and the values, but comes at it from a different perspective, from a different walk of life than I do. I think that's very valuable.
Yeah, it sounds like it's interesting to hear you and Governor Beshear's like complementary leadership styles. Like, how did you all working together? How did that help you two as the, you know, only Democratic elected official statewide governing a state with a Republican supermajority in the legislature. Like, how were you able to deal with that?
Yeah, we are the only, so Governor Bashir are the only Democrats elected statewide. And then we have a supermajority Republican House and Senate. So we are in a lot of ways on an island by ourselves. So having each other to bounce ideas off of, to be able to divide and conquer in terms of like covering areas, showing up in different places, you know, leading different initiatives has been really important. You know, the lieutenant governor role in Kentucky is largely undefined in statute. So that also means that you get to define it. Mm-hmm. And so working with him and really kind of finding our niche and finding our different roles and how we can be best to help the administration has been really an interesting thing. But, you know, how people say, well, what does the lieutenant governor do? And I say, well, whatever the governor and she decide to do. You know, I mean, that's ultimately what it is in Kentucky.
Yeah. And it's interesting, during, you know, during your time with lieutenant governor, you were also briefly secretary of education, workforce mm-hmm. development. And I know you were also pursuing doctoral studies at the University of Kentucky. Like, what inspired you to take on all those roles together?
So when we won, I wanted to make sure that we got, because our education was central to our campaign, and we have proudly said that we have an education first administration since the very beginning. So I wanted us to make sure that we got off on the right foot to lead the education cabinet and workforce development cabinet in that way. So I think that was very symbolic, and it was very important to me to make sure that we got going in the way that we needed to for the issue that was most important to us. And then in terms of the doctorate, I actually started that in 2016. Okay. So it was long before I ever knew I was going to run for office. I finished my coursework in our first primary. So,
oh, wow.
Yes. And so, I have, been chipping away at that dissertation. It's taking me longer than it should have. Obviously I had to put it on hold for now, cause I'm a little busy, but, eventually I will make sure that I finish that. But my dissertation is on youth mental health.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a great topic. That was one of my focuses at the Council of State Government. Mm-hmm. So I greatly appreciate that. I can imagine you have, like, of all the students in the class, the best excuses to be like, sorry, I need an extension. I'm busy running the state.
That's right. My dog ate my homework.
What advice do you offer to aspiring leaders, especially educators who want to make a broader impact, whether that's by starting organizations like you or running for office or being involved in policymaking?
Well, first I would say so many people think that they have to go to law school to run for office. And I would say that you don't have to do that, right? We have a lot of attorneys in mm-hmm. state government. There are a lot of people that can advise you legally. Obviously, it can benefit you if you choose to go to law school, but you don't have to if that's not your thing. But also, you don't have to run for office to be a leader either. And so my advice to young people is, it's very general because we're all walking different paths with different interests and different passions, but I would say three things. Number one, find your passion. Number two, get involved. And number three, take the lead. So we all have different passions, and we should, right? Mine is education. And so that passion led me into this leadership role, but it's because I got involved. I was a leader in different organizations. I was very active in the teacher movement of 2017 when our pensions were on the line, if people mm-hmm. remember that in Kentucky. But also that last step is the one we forget. Don't be afraid to step out and take the lead because you have the passion. You've been involved to build the relationships, to get the experience. And so that last step is the most important, to take all of those things that you've gained and use them to help other people.
I was like, yes, it's an important to have that combination. And it makes me think a lot, too, about people with different perspectives and leadership. A lot of my background work has been in diversity, equity, and inclusion and accessibility, mm-hmm. like DEIA. You know, you as a policymaker, but also as a teacher, how do you view and look at like the attacks happening on DEI now, both at the state level and like federally?
It's really frustrating to me to think about the challenges that so many people face for different reasons. Challenges that, you know, as a woman I can relate to, but as a white person, I can't. But that's why I think it's so important that you listen, right? I'm doing a lot of talking today, obviously, because I'm doing an interview, but I really like to ask questions and listen, because that's where you learn, and that's where you pick up on different things that you would never know unless someone else talked to you about them, if you didn't have those experiences. And so I think to attack DEI is just an affront to really refusing to listen to the different experiences that people have and helping make them better. That's really all it is. It doesn't, you know, I just don't think it should matter, you know, where you come from or who you are. You should be able to achieve things in the same way that other people can. But if there are people who are ignorant to your, and I don't say ignorant in a, I don't mean that in a mean way, but just unaware, right, of your own experiences, then they can't meet you where you are. And to me, DEI is, you know, that we say, and, you know, Governor always says it's not a four-letter word. It's what makes us special. But to me, it's just very simply getting to know people and meeting them where they are. That's all they're asking you to do. It's not this evil thing that it's made out to be. It's really unfortunate the way that it's been attacked.
Yeah, definitely. And with that, what have been some of your biggest challenges in your leadership journey?
So I would say, as certainly in a campaign and as an elected official, the thing that's most frustrating to me is the partisanship. Mm-hmm. People have become so dependent upon identifying themselves by their party. And for so many people, it's almost like the letter by their name is the most interesting thing about them, which is actually, to me, is very sad. I think it, you know, I would hope that the letter by my name is not the most interesting thing about me. But that, to me, is what stymies any kind of progress that we can make. Just because to know that you're sitting across the table from somebody who is going to dig their heels in and they're not going to give just because you don't belong to the same party as them really shortchanges Kentuckians. And that as somebody who's a teacher whose job has always been to get stuff done really, really bothers me, because I think we have so much potential in Kentucky, and the only thing standing between us and that is partisanship.
And with that, in addition to like political party labels, like, I guess, how do you also approach like just, I mean, I guess political labels, like, you know, some people say progressive, liberal, some people say you and the governor are moderate, some say progressives. Like, how do you deal with those labels?
I don't like using political labels. I've made the mistake of doing it before, and I don't think it does anyone justice. I don't think anything is that simple. Everything is very nuanced. Also, I just think it's, in a way, like if your opponents are using it to attack you or the media is using it to describe you, I think that's lazy, mm-hmm. right? It's just lazy. It's just, you can't possibly define someone in one word. There's just such a broad scale for just the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, and it's a sliding scale, right? And quite frankly, the vast majority of people are somewhere in the middle. They may agree on one issue, but not on another. That doesn't necessarily mean that puts them in opposite camps. It just means that sometimes they agree and sometimes they don't. I don't think we have to oppose each other with labels. And I think sometimes people just do it to keep it succinct. Sometimes I think they do it because they're lazy. But ultimately, I don't think it does anybody justice to identify themselves by any label, political or otherwise.
And how do you and the administration approach, like, I think sometimes people put these together, but I think they're separate, like governing in a bipartisan manner versus leading in like a nonpartisan manner.
Yes. So there are so many issues that I have referred to as being bipartisan that actually should be nonpartisan, you know, education being one of them, right? You know, we have Democrats and Republicans working in our schools. The kids, most of them, don't even have a political party, right? Because they're not old enough to vote yet. So it just, again, shortchanges people when you kind of resort to that.
And what are also some of your proudest accomplishments along your leadership journey?
As a lieutenant governor, I equate it to being like an assistant coach, right? So you don't see the assistant coach's name in the paper. You don't, you know, for better or worse, they're not the ones doing the interviews after the games, right? That's what the head coach does. And so everything I've done as lieutenant governor is in service to the administration. And so a lot of folks may not know about it. But I've been pretty proud of some of the things I've been able to accomplish as Lieutenant Governor. So first of all, we had the Student Mental Health Initiative, and it was completely student-led, and we were able to bring $40 million to Kentucky for school-based mental health services. One day, I remember the governor and I were talking about paid family leave and childcare, and how we, you know, were hoping that, you know, we could incentivize businesses to offer those things in the private sector. And I remember looking at him and saying, now, Governor, we need to put our money where our mouth is, right? We need to be willing to do what we're asking other people to do and be that example. And so for the first time in history, state government employees have paid family leave. And in September, we are going to cut the ribbon on our first child care center for state employees. And so those are, that's again, an example of meeting people where they are and helping them to be better, not just at work, but at home and in their communities. I mean, this is a you know, full circle moment of being able to support human beings, right? My big pet peeve is when people refer to, you know, Kentuckians as workers. I don't like that because, again, that is a label that shortchanges people. They're human beings. They're family members, they're community members. And so if you call them a worker, to me, you're referring to them as like a cog in your wheel. And so these programs that I'm talking about, mental health, paid family leave, childcare, are our attempt to meet people where they are. And I think that's really important.
Yeah, and I can definitely see that, like, again, your experience as a teacher, like that class of inspiration. And can you tell us more too about how you, coming from a rural area, like myself from Eastern Kentucky, but now here in Lexington, like coming from a rural area, but also like having to govern in the city and balancing, like, I guess, the urban and rural divide in Kentucky?
There's a lot of folks who talk about a rural-urban divide, and I can certainly see where that comes from, but I will tell you that it doesn't matter where I am in Kentucky. The challenges might look different, but they are very similar, right? Affordable housing is an issue that I know the elected folks in Louisville and Lexington talk about all the time. Well, it's also the number one issue that was mentioned to me in Owsley County and in Harlan County, right? So that's just one example of how this issue, and it's not even, you know, it's not even unique to Kentucky. It's a national issue. And we're all trying to figure out how to solve this problem. But the root of the problem is what's different. So, for example, in urban centers, they may have the resources, but they don't have the space. Or they have, you know, maybe more excessive planning and zoning laws than in rural Kentucky. In rural Kentucky, they've got the space. They probably don't have the bureaucracy, but they also don't have the resources. And so it's just it's two different ways of ending up facing the same challenge, and while it looks different, really it's all the same, very similar.
And we talked about both some of your biggest successes and your biggest troubles as a leader. I was curious too if you've ever experienced toxic leadership and how, you know, you've dealt with that.
Oh yeah, I think we all have, right? To me, I think the toxic leadership that really has a negative impact on people is when the leader is self-serving, right? When they're not doing the work for the right reasons, when they have lost the plot, you know, maybe they were elected or maybe they were hired to a leadership position with a goal in mind, and somewhere along the way they've lost their way and they've forgotten what's important. So often the negative stories we hear, certainly about elected officials, is when they are really trying to serve themselves and they're not concerned about their constituents. It's all about me, me, me. That toxic leadership, I think, is probably worse than any other.
And again, I think that sounds like that ties very well back to the classroom of, like, you have to, you know, you as a teacher, not thinking about yourself, you're thinking about these dozens of kids you have to lead and manage, right?
Exactly. And you know, it's not about what you're comfortable with or what you want. It's about what that child needs, right? Meeting them where they are, but also building that relationship with them. I wasn't always successful as a teacher. You never are. But when you put forth the effort, I still like to think those kids notice that, and that matters to them, you know. And the more that they can relate to you or know that you care, the more that they are willing to learn from you. And that's really how you make that progress.
Can you share more about that? I appreciate you saying that, like, that you weren't always successful as a teacher. I know my first year of teaching, I think I failed my first year of teaching. It took me a while to get good at it, and I don't know if I ever did get good at it. But can you tell us more about that, like, that struggle and, like, having failures as a teacher and how that impacts you?
Oh, gosh, I think about that, and you're right. I think every teacher would probably say what you just said, right? I want to go back to my first-year students and say, I am so sorry. I thought I was doing my job, and I was doing the best that I could, but I was not good enough. But every year, I would find a new idea or, a new project, a new concept, and I would get so excited about it, and I would do it the next year. I think, gosh, I'm so much better than I was last year. Mm-hmm. And then the next year, I'd do the same thing and the same thing because, you know, I don't understand how, as an educator, you don't feel like you fail at least a little bit mm-hmm. every single day. I mean, I fell short every day in one way or another. But what ultimately I think made me good at my job and made my students appreciate me was that I got up the next day and kept trying, right? Or learned from my mistakes or did something differently. And so I would have never gotten better if I hadn't learned from my previous mistakes, right? It's the same thing as a coach and an athlete. I mean, every single practice, every single game, I made a mistake. So did my players. So did the officials. But you learn from it. You watch film. As a coach, I'd go home and I'd just replay the game in my mind and think about why I made certain decisions and what I should have done differently. And I try to learn from it the next time. So there's no way that you can get better unless you fail, right? But I do believe that it's the resilience. Mm-hmm. It is the, pulling yourself up and getting better the next day that is truly the lesson that you learn along the way.
Yeah, it's definitely the ultimate career for that. I remember I was very lucky. My first year teaching had mostly sophomores. My third year, mostly seniors, and it was actually most of the same students.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember them saying, oh, Mr. Sichter, like, you're so much better this year. You're so much more confident. You know what you're talking about. And I'm like, oh. So it was cool to hear that, like, I did become better. So
that is good. That is good, yeah.
I have these three key components of leadership. I need a trademark one day, but I call them my three M's, being an effective motivator, a competent manager, and then a supportive mentor. So how do you kind of view those three M's of motivation, management, and mentorship? And do you see them as three very distinct things, or do you see them as all like tied together?
I think they're all tied together. And when you said those three things, my mind went back to coaching. Mm-hmm. Because those are the things that you're constantly doing as a coach of young people. Again, they're certainly not easy, and you learn a little bit more every single day about it. But to be able to motivate people, that might be the toughest one. Yeah. Is to get to get everybody on the same page, rowing in the same direction, is not an easy thing to do. To manage the different personalities, the different perspectives, the different experiences, certainly is difficult. And then, of course, the mentorship to me is being that example and showing, not just telling your students or your employees what to do, but showing them how to do it, I think is really important too.
And you said like motivation is kind of the hardest one. Of those three, do you have one that's your favorite? And then is there one that you're best at, if that's a different one?
Oh gosh. I think just by nature of being a teacher and a coach, I would say my best one would probably be mentorship. Even though that one is difficult because it's about interpersonal relationships. I think that one is what comes most naturally to me probably.
And then how do you, like, thinking about those styles of leadership, how do you kind of balance being a leader of like leading with your head versus leading with your heart?
Yeah, that's a hard one. I think this is why you have to have really good people around you. You have to have people who are, willing to tell you the truth, even when you don't want to hear it, especially when you don't want to hear it. You have to be willing to ask the questions that get the answers that are hard to hear. But your people that are around you also have to know that you trust them, right? And so I'll use myself and Governor Beshear as an example. We've had lots of conversations, just he and I, about different policies, different programs, different moves that we might make. And, I had to be okay with giving him my advice and my opinion, and then knowing that that decision was in his hands, right? That is a hard thing to do as someone who has, you know, leadership tendencies. You want things to go the way you want them to go. But ultimately, whether you're an assistant principal or an assistant coach, whatever it is, whatever role you're in, lieutenant governor, you have to do your best to advise and provide counsel that matters and is important. You have to be trusted by the other person to do that. The governor will listen to me no matter what I say to him. And I can tell you it's been, you know, we've had some interesting conversations, and he listens all mm-hmm. the way through them. He may or may not take my advice, but that's ultimately on him, because that's his job, right? And you know, you have to be okay with that. You have to be okay with speaking your piece and letting the chips fall where they might. Sometimes things go your way and sometimes they don't. But again, lessons learned in all of it.
And one of the key themes of this podcast, bringing the local and global context together. So like, how do you think of yourself as like a global citizen, as someone who looks at like what's happening around the world? How does that affect what's happening here in Kentucky and the work you do?
You know, it's all so interconnected, and yet some of it feels so far away. But when you look at the challenges that we face, regardless of what your area of expertise may be, whether, you know, it's hunger, homelessness, healthcare, education, those are challenges all over the world. And there are certainly challenges all over this country, all over this Commonwealth, in every single community. And sometimes those issues can feel so large, especially when you're talking like a state budget or a mm-hmm. national budget. Those numbers are overwhelming. But ultimately, it comes down to one person, one family, one community. And if you can keep your mindset grounded, I think, to that level, to where you are making a personal impact on people, then you recognize that every day you chip away just a little bit more at it, right? And you get a little bit more right. That can be hard because it's a long game, and it requires patience and persistence that not everybody has. But certainly when you take those massive issues that seem overwhelming and think, how can I help, you know, the kids in my classroom, the families in my church, the, you know, families in my community, whatever it is that you're talking about, you can start to really feel like you're making a difference. And I think that's really what anybody want. Most people want is to know that they're making a difference. And so it starts at home. Right? Starts at home. It's no matter how big the issue is, one person at a time.
And how do you hope to show the world, like, what we here at Kentucky, like, what Kentucky has to offer the world?
The most special thing about Kentucky is our people. And I've seen it in the best of times, and I've seen it in the worst of times. You know, you walk through a community like Mayfield after the historic tornado that we had that just flattened the whole community. And you see people who've lost homes, who are showing up to work at the you know, local community to feed families. Mm-hmm. In Eastern Kentucky after the flood, mm-hmm. I remember seeing people bringing donations to the school. That's where most communities turn, right? And after a disaster, the schools become the hubs. Mm-hmm. People bringing in donations. I saw a woman who was working in the cafeteria at an elementary school in Bremen, Kentucky, who lost her home the night before. And she showed up and was serving food to the community. And her, you know, mindset was, you know, what's gone is gone. And if I just sit around and sulk about it, it's not going to help anybody. But if I come here, I can feed people and I can help them feel better. And I'm just like, you know, for all the negativity that we see, all the controversy that's out there, all the partisanship that drags us down, that is who we are. That's who we are in Kentucky. And in all of that, nobody asked anybody else about their political party, mm-hmm. about some culture war social issue and what their feelings were about it before they helped them. They just showed up and helped. And I just, you know, it's my hope that it doesn't take a natural disaster or, you know, a once in a lifetime, you know, tragedy to remind us that that's really what's important.
Yeah, I've definitely seen that. Like, again, being from Eastern Kentucky, you mentioned the flooding. Like, yeah, just seeing how the community came together and did that. I know what's happened to my parents' house, our neighbors helping each other at. I know a few winters ago, we had the power go out in our whole neighborhood, and our neighbor across the street was like, hey, come over. Like, come over and stay. Bring your grandma over. Our cousins from Florida, who'd never seen snow before, were visiting.
They were like, bring
them all over. You can stay with us. And we're like, oh, my gosh. Like, that's just, like, so nice. You let, like, nine people into your house.
Right. Well, so in Wolf County, they didn't get hit by the flood the way that, I mean, they obviously had some rain, but they didn't lose things the way that other communities did. They opened up all three of their gyms, elementary, middle, and high school, to people from surrounding communities. So, like, there was a hospital that they had to evacuate, and they brought those people into the gym in Wolf County. There was one gym that was for families with pets, and then there was one gym for families without pets. And, like, the way that they just showed, and the superintendent and the teachers and the volunteers from the community just showed up and started asking how they could help, right? They may not have known these people. They certainly weren't from that community, but it didn't matter. Those things are the things that stick with me and that are just so just heartening about the people around us. And it's those are the things that I remember, especially when times are tough. I try to keep that, you know, at the forefront of my mind and say, you know, remind myself, this is who we are.
I think I know I like that you mentioned, like, volunteers helping out with those disasters, and also, like, the heart of Kentuckians to volunteer and help out. I know one of my biggest struggles in leadership is, like, when I'm working with volunteers, like, you know, getting them motivated to, like, you know, fight for a cause or be there. Because, like, okay, if you're getting paid for the job, you know, you got to do it, versus if you're volunteering.
Right.
Like, I guess me just asking for personal advice, like, how do you all manage volunteers, whether on the campaign or volunteers you help you all do, like, the policy work? How do you do with that?
I think the important thing with managing volunteers and motivating them is you let them do what they do best, right? Everybody has their lane. You know, there may be something that one person's good at that, you know, another person has no interest in doing this job, but this person does. You really just help them to move towards what gives them joy, because that's what's going to keep them invested and keep them coming back. And if they can find joy in that work, they'll keep doing it. If you ask them to do something that, you know, they're not really good at or they don't enjoy, they're probably not going to be very invested in it. And so I just think you let people find what they're good at and empower them to do it. And that will help you as much as anything.
It's definitely great advice. What would be the first thing you do if you become governor?
Oh, first thing I do when I become governor. I think it will be putting together a group of people. Let's call it, for today, let's call it the Kentucky Kids Council, of people who have worked in, been around, volunteered for, been raised in the child welfare system in Kentucky, the foster care system in Kentucky. Those kids deserve a voice, and they don't have the voice that they deserve right now. And so bringing people to the table who have done the work, who have experienced it for themselves, who recognize, you know, all of the different, you know, kinks in the system that need to be worked out. To me, I think that is one of the greatest things that we can do, is to show up and serve kids who really don't have anybody else showing up for them, and who deserve a voice in government that they don't necessarily have because they don't have these high-powered lobbyists like all these big, you know, companies and groups do. And so I want to be their voice, and I want to be their lobbyist.
And it sounds like, yeah, you'll be a great voice for that, given your experience. What are key leadership lessons you've learned from books or writings or publications?
Oh, gosh. So I would say I'm going to point to two books that I really enjoyed. One personally in my profession, but one for building teams. So the one for me was Atomic Habits. That is one where you, like, sometimes you lack motivation or you lack organization, and you really want to figure out how to get it together and feel more competent and more prepared. Atomic Habits is a really good book for that, that I enjoyed. And then one that I gave everybody in my office, is called The Culture Code. And it's about essentially building a team, and working towards the same mission and at the heart of it, you know, at the heart of building that culture, it's always about helping other people, and it's always about living in service. And that book helps really center that and remind you of why you're doing what you're doing and why that's important. So I would recommend those two books, Atomic Habits and The Culture Code.
Okay. And are there any major like pop culture figures or TV shows or movies that have inspired you a lot with leadership?
So this is what I'll say about, this is what people always say about government. They say what people think government is House of Cards. What they hope it is The West Wing. But what it really is Veep.
Yep.
That would probably be the best way. And I've seen all three of them. And I'm going to tell you that's probably true.
Yep. Say West Wing, my favorite TV show growing up. So that's what inspired me to want to do policy work. So
Yes. Jed Bartlett. We all love him.
Yep. It's funny. My sister, she works in D.C. and other friends in D.C. have all said Veep is probably the most accurate.
Oh, it absolutely is.
Like everyone there, it's like they're really ambitious and they're kind of corrupt, but it's like they're either average intelligence or less, but like their ambition trumps their intelligence. So it's like, that's what the people are really like.
And like, as funny as that show is in so many ways, there are so many moments every single day that I'm like, this could be a Veep episode. It really is. Yeah.
Nice. Hopefully maybe that could be part of some of the first things you do as governor, making a Veep style documentary.
There you go. So. That's right. Oh gosh, I'd be afraid to do that.
And who would you say are your most important leadership role models?
Leadership role models. So certainly in Kentucky, I would point to two really important women in my life. First is Martha Lane Collins. She is, you know, most people don't recognize across the country that Kentucky has already had a female governor. Mm-hmm. So when people ask me, you know, is Kentucky ready for a female governor? And I say, well, that question was asked and answered 40 years ago, you know? But she was such an iconic, important, influential person in our history, not just because she was the first woman governor, but when you think about the economic impact bringing Toyota to Kentucky has had on generations of families, as well as, you know, her leadership in the education realm, because she was also a teacher, right? She just has had such an impact that's lasting for families. And the impact that she had on me was, I remember being a little girl and meeting her, and no one ever said to me, this is the first woman governor. They said, this is Governor Martha Lane Collins. And so to me, that was always possible because you can't be what you can't see, right? And then the second person I would point to is former Lieutenant Governor Crit Llewellyn. She is one of the most upstanding, polished, professional, fair people that you'll ever meet. And I think, I believe that people on both sides of the aisle would all say that about her. And to know that, you know, her work over seven governor's administrations in total, really paved the way for me to be where I am today. It is important to me. The fact that I can pick up the phone and call her and ask her advice and get her feedback is still something I can't hardly believe that I get to do. But she's just so wise and brilliant and experienced and just ethical, you know, just someone who is going to give you good advice and lead you down the right path. And that's certainly what we all need a little bit more of. So I would say those two women for sure.
Both great leaders. I hadn't realized she'd worked for so many administrations. That's amazing.
Yeah.
And I'd forgot, like, I of course knew about Martha Lane Collins, but I'd forgot she was a former educator too.
Yes.
So definitely both great inspirational figures. And do you have any fictional role models? You mentioned Jed Bartlett, of course, one of mine too. Any fictional role models you look up to for leadership?
Fictional role models. It's not Selena Meyer, I'll tell you that. what a great character she has. I don't know if there's any fictional characters, because it's so much of it is you know, created in a, you know, and sometimes in a fantasy world. Mm-hmm. I think we all love Jed Bartlett, right? Like, he was great. But yeah, I don't really look to fictional characters too much. I try to keep my mind in reality on that.
And if you hadn't entered public service, what do you think your career would have been like? I guess would it have continued in education, or what do you think would have been happening, or where would you be now?
I think I would be a sports broadcaster. Yeah, that's what I, that if I could, you know, maybe like do whatever I wanted to, I think I would do that now.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I know WKY, we have a sports show and I think we're always looking for new shows. So if you ever want
to come up with a, like a cute little name for it, you know, yeah. But I love sports. I played basketball, so I know that one the best. But yeah, I would love to be able to do that, to lift up, especially female athletes and really bring even more attention to the sport and to their craft would be amazing. Hmm.
And thinking of sports and sort of the local global context, are you excited for the World Cup being part of it in the U.S. this year?
Yes. I wish I understood soccer better. I just do not really understand it much, but yeah, what a cool event that we get to host in the United States, and I just like think it's going to be bigger than we could possibly imagine because soccer is so big around the world, but it's going to be so exciting. I just anything that when you get to that level, you know, I could pretty much watch any sport because it's just such a cool thing to be able to experience.
Yeah. And I appreciate you mentioning the importance of female sports. That's one sport people don't recognize where the women's team has won like so many World Cups. I mean, global, whereas the men's team like. You know, they made it to the World Cup a few times, and we're impressed by that, but people don't even, like, know that.
Yeah. I do think, you know, women's basketball is having a moment. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really, you know, come on in the last few years for the, you know, population in general. But their success was built on the backs of those female soccer players because they were so successful. Mm-hmm. And they were the ones, that group of women were the ones that pushed so hard for equal pay. Yeah. And they were the ones that really brought all that to the forefront. And so, you know, it just across all sports, I think it's important that we show up for each other. But like thinking about, you know, the experiences that women had before, especially when I go to like basketball games now, you know, I love going to watch college basketball. And when I go to those games, the little girls that are in the stands are so cute and I just get so excited for them. But it's the older women that I just think, like, I get warm fuzzies looking at them in the stands because I'm like, they played before Title IX. They probably didn't even have uniforms. You know, they probably didn't even have a bus. And to look at how far the game has come now and to see that these older women paved the way, I think is a really cool thing too. So I really zone in on both of those groups when I go to games and it just makes me so happy.
That's great to see that, like, that generation's coming together for
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
And what is your favorite sport to watch, and what's your favorite sport to play?
Okay, so my favorite sport to watch is basketball. I think the only sport I can play is basketball. So I think it depends on the game. Like, I can watch anything, but, like, I want it to be, like, a really competitive game. If it's a really good game, I'll watch anything. But basketball comes most naturally to me because I grew up in a basketball family. I played, my husband played and coached, all of our kids did. So that's the one that's most fun to me. But I will tell you what I've taken a real liking to lately, and I did not have the opportunity to play this sport, but I wish I did, is volleyball.
Oh, okay.
I love watching volleyball now. I think they're just so good. It's so fun to watch. Yeah.
So one of my favorite sports movie scenes is the original Top Gun, that volleyball scene.
There you go.
And I guess you've mentioned, you know, your husband's a coach too, and you know your kids are in sports. Do you find yourselves as a family, as parents, like, I guess, coaching them through with everything?
I am very good at separating myself because I coached our oldest daughter. She actually played for me, and I adopted her. So our first relationship was coach player. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, her AAU coaches asked me to coach their team, and I said nope. You know, she's got to learn to play for somebody else. And, you know, when she went off to college, you know, I was a parent. You know, what I always said as a coach is you have four roles in a gym. You can be a player, you can be a spectator, you can be an official, or you can be a coach. You cannot be more than one at the same time. And so when I would go to watch, you know, the boys or Emma play, I was a spectator and that was my role. And I really separated myself from being a coach. Chris is not very good at that. That's my husband. I spent a lot of time sticking my elbow in his ribs during Emma's games in college. But yeah, I enjoyed taking a step back, I enjoyed watching her play in college and all of that. But certainly we would not have the relationship we had if I didn't coach her. originally. So I think you just have to know your role.
That's amazing. Having a student who you were coaching and then adopting, that's an amazing story.
Yeah.
And what are who are your favorite like sports teams?
My favorite sports teams. I try to not pick favorites, mainly because, especially these days with NIL, they all give me commitment issues now. But I just like a good game. Like, it doesn't matter what sport it is or who's playing. I just like a good game. I've even picked up watching some tennis lately, too. So.
And then whenever UK and U of L are playing, then you don't root for one side? Or who do you
okay,
root for?
I'm going to give you this answer, and it's not a political answer. My grandfather was U of L's first 1,000-point scorer.
Wow.
And is in the Hall of Fame there. I was a grad assistant for the women's basketball team when I was in grad school. And I also grew up close to Lexington. So growing up watching basketball with my grandfather, he would cheer for UK and U of L because he always said it's good for our state if both teams are good. Now, when they played each other, he would obviously cheer for U of L. But, like, he wasn't one of those people that, like, hated the other team. And so I root for both of them, and I hope they're all successful. And I really don't have a favorite. I think it would probably depend on the year, maybe, like with the team and kind of how they are and the personalities. But now with NIL, they're here for a year and they're gone. So it becomes tougher, I think.
My last question, we started this interview with your six-word story. Now I want to know, what is your six-word legacy? The six words that you hope people will remember when they think of you and your impact on Kentucky and on the world.
Oh, wow. I think I would say the same ones. I think I would hope people recognize that I was somebody who showed up, who listened, and who got stuff done. At the end of the day, it's we make things a little too complicated. That's very simple.
Awesome. Well, Lieutenant Governor Coleman, thank you so much for taking the time for this interview. It's been great to meet you and hear about your work. You're a personal hero of mine, so just greatly inspired by the work you're doing, and good luck with everything.
Thank you so much.
That wraps up my conversation with Jacqueline Coleman. What stood out to me from our discussion was how her leadership is grounded in people, from her family to the students she taught, to the kids she coached, and of course, the community she serves. You can see that in her work and her advocacy for youth mental health, and how she collaborates with others to help move Kentucky forward. And Lieutenant Governor Coleman shared two comparisons that really stuck with me from the interview. First, I loved how she said that coaching is the political side of leadership, while teaching is the governing side. And the second was her take on politics through television, that people think it's House of Cards, they hope it's the West Wing, but in reality, it's often Veep. It's a humorous observation that captures the complexity and the unpredictability of public service. And of course, we ended the conversation by talking about sports, bringing everything full circle. Thanks for listening to Local Global Leaders. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with someone who may enjoy it too. My next episode drops in September and features Vanessa Grossel, Kentucky State Representative for District 88. Until then, remember to live local and think global, fellow changemakers.